Artie is too fat to fish. Where did you come up with that?
I don't know, my mother said, half smiling. I just had to stop him any way I could. But Ma, do you realize what you sounded like?
It finally dawned on my mother, and when it did, she started laughing. Then I did too, and pretty soon all three of us were sitting there at the table, red-faced, not able to breathe over the fact that she not only made that up on the spot, but forced me to call my boss and tell him, as a 23-year-old man, that I could not go fishing. And then she told the guy herself that I was too fat to fish. The ball breaking started the minute I walked into work Monday, and it never stopped. Things at the port remained more or less the same until the Brazilian guy whose orange juice we were unloading got an idea in his head about cutting operating costs to increase his profit. The name we'll give this guy is Camacho, and he was paying his Brazilian workers like one fucking dollar a day to pick oranges for 15 hours. Then in Newark, he was paying us $19 an hour or $38 an hour with double time to fucking play Pinochle at 500 Rummy. He thought that if he could get scabs in there to break the union, he'd be making much more money, which of course he would be. In Camacho's eyes, he was ripping people off at one end and getting ripped off at the other end. In our eyes, we were doing a fucking dangerous job, and we deserved that money, which was a wage we were proud of the union for getting us. Sure enough, in time, this guy at South America tried to break the union. One day, we showed up for work and were locked out. Then, about an hour after we were supposed to be at work, he brought in about 30 Portuguese men in armored buses with big grates over the windows and doors. They pulled right up and let these scabs out. We were told these guys were going to work for half our wage and that the operation was no longer a union shop. I feel privileged to have been there during this time because, let me tell you, longshoremen know how to fucking strike. We immediately picked up rocks, started throwing everything we could get our hands on at this fucking bus. The Portuguese guys were scared shitless, but the drivers got them in the gate and they locked us out. Someone in our crew put in a call to the powers that be while the rest of us continued to disrupt the work being done in every way that we could. This was the start of weeks of bitter striking. Every day we were out there picketing with signs, and guys were slashing tires and doing all kinds of shit. It was serious. One day this guy got pulled out of a truck, and the longshoreman just beat the crap out of him. I didn't really want to hurt anybody, and I didn't know what the fuck to do. I really wanted to make it as a comedian and didn't want to get arrested. So I kept my distance and threw things and watched the nutty shit the other guys did. These guys were fighting for their jobs. Who could blame them? It wasn't just a job. It was all they had. There were guys down there with not a lot of skills and families to support. There was nowhere else in the world they could land another gig like that. They were fighting for their livelihood. The union was great. They were very protective of our position and promised us that it would blow over. If it didn't work out, they said, we'd get work for equal pay elsewhere. At this point, I had about $6,000 saved in the bank. Enough was enough, and I thought it was my time to go. I was about to turn 24. I lived with my mother, so I didn't have to worry about rent, and I had $6,000. I decided that I'd get in my car every single night going to the city to open mic and amateur comedy nights. I had thought about it nonstop for the past 2 years. How could I not, staring at the New York skyline from Port Newark every day? I think to myself, it's right fucking there. What are you doing here? I knew I'd be leaving a job that other people would kill for, that would take care of me for life, but I kept thinking that I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I pussied out and didn't try my best. That was it. I was going to start from scratch with no family or friends to give me advice about show business, and I was going to try to make it as a comedian. At the same time, I knew I was crazy for thinking of leaving. I'd been working for the union from February of 91 to September of 92, working on the docks with a real cast of characters. All I'd had to do was show up and mention my friend's father's name, and I was given a job. In 1991, I made about $60,000. If you had 700 hours in for the year, you qualified for what's called a container check, a truly amazing thing that the Longshoremen's Union does for its members. My buddy's father was instrumental in getting this thing going. He'd worked with the union and port management to clean the place up, and once he did, he went back to them with a plan to keep things that way. His point was that the port was busier than ever, that everybody was prospering, so he suggested that at Christmas time, each longshoreman be paid a penny or 2 cents for every container moved through the port in the year. Management agreed, so around Christmas in a busy year, a container check could be worth $4,000 or $5,000. In 91, it was like $4,500, of which I gave $2,000 to my mother as a Christmas present. I had not been able to help out much since my father's accident because I'd been so self-destructive. I had taken that union job specifically to be able to pay her back and help her out, and I was happy finally to be able to do that in some small way. It came at a good time, too, because my mother had a lot of expenses that year. We were still dealing with welfare and Medicaid, and it was all really depressing.
My mother, to her complete credit, never once discouraged me from following my dream. I don't think a lot of mothers, if I were their son, would have done the same. As a matter of fact, she was upset that I was working at the port to help support her. As I've mentioned, she desperately tried to protect me and my sister financially and emotionally from my father's accident, which, of course, was completely impossible. My mother looked at my work down at the port, as well as some of the drug, drinking, and gambling problems I had, as a byproduct of my father's accident. I think she saw these things as her failure, but she was wrong. That shit is just in my personality, and I would have gone through that rebellious time no matter what. My mom didn't see it that way, and she felt guilty. So when I told her I wanted to take my savings and live off it for as long as I could while I pursued my dream, she was elated and supported it wholeheartedly. It would have been nearly impossible to get through all the rejections and hard times that lay ahead of me if my mother didn't believe in me. Before I could start chasing my dream, I had to take care of one last thing. I had to tell my buddy's father, the great man I'm indebted to for life, who'd gotten me the job, that I wanted to quit. I felt incredibly guilty. He had done me such a huge favor. I had to quit the proper, respectful way. I had to thank him and explain my reasons for leaving. I was scared shitless, because I knew he'd be mad. I ran through different ways that conversation would go down, with me attempting to explain why I needed to try my best to be a comedian, but there really wasn't any way I could make it sound like a reasonable decision. I waited outside his office for like 2 hours, which did nothing much for my nerves. I brought him a nice bottle of wine that I gave him, sat down, probably looking as nervous as I felt. "Thanks for the wine, Mike," he said. "So how've you been?" "Oh, fine, I'm doing all right." "Glad to hear it. So, Mike, what can I do for you?" For the entire meeting, the guy called me Mike, which had me on the verge of laughing the entire time. He'd gotten another friend of ours, one of the millions of Mikes, a job too, and he'd clearly gotten us confused, but I wasn't about to correct him. He was a nice enough guy, but he was one of those really impressive, really intimidating union guys. He was an incredible public speaker whenever I saw him at union events. From the moment he shook your hand, you could tell that he was not a guy to be fucked with. "Listen, sir," I said, "this has been the greatest couple of years of my life because I made all of this money and was able to help my mother out and save some money for myself for the first time in my life. I'm glad to have helped you out, Mike. I'm glad I could give you that opportunity." "Well, sir, I don't know if your son ever told you about this, but I'm an aspiring comedian," I said. "I really want to get into show business, and the only way I can do it properly is to quit right here and now and get a part-time job and go in and out of New York City whenever I can to auditions." He looked at me like I had three heads. "What?" he said. "I'm not sure I heard you just right. What are you going to do?" "I need to quit the job to be able to go to New York and make it in show business." "Listen to me, Mike," he said very seriously. "This is a great job. People kill for this job. You are not appreciating what you've been given." "I do appreciate it, sir. I really do," I said. "I wouldn't be able to even attempt to pursue this if it weren't for this job. I saved up enough money to give me some leeway until I get a part-time job while I try to make it." "And what are you going to do for the rest of your life?" he said. "Well, I'm going to try to make it in show business. I'm going to do whatever it takes." "I don't even know what to say to that, Mike," he said. "What are the odds of that happening? You're just going to waltz into New York City and make it?" Everything he said was right, and he wasn't insulted as much as he was concerned. After all, he had about 100 names ready to take my spot. "Mike, I want you to rethink this," he said. "Have you told your mother about this?"
"Yes, sir."
"And what did she say?"
"My mother was actually supportive of it."
"You're a real good friend of my son, Mike, or else he wouldn't have asked me to help you out after your dad died," he said, looking at me very seriously. "Listen, I love you, and there's nothing I wouldn't do for you. That's why I'm going to be honest with you, since other people might not be. Listen to me. There's about a 50-million-to-1 shot that you're going to make it in show business. It's not easy. If it was, everyone would do it."
"I know that," I said. "I'm ready for that. I'm going to give it my all. You know, in high school, I was kind of the class clown. I could get laughs and stuff." Around this guy, I was not, however. I was nothing but shy.
"That's it? A class clown? You really need to rethink this. That's not going to cut it." This went on for a while longer until finally he gave up. He looked me in the eye, realized that I was serious, and that was it. "Well, listen, Mike, I cannot guarantee you anything, but when it doesn't work out, you come to us and we'll try to get you another job here." I always thought it was funny that he said when and not if. It wasn't malicious. He cared about me, that was all. But he didn't consider success a possibility for me. I will never forget him for extending that offer because he was completely serious and way more generous than he should have been with me. I wasn't family, but he treated me like his own. He took the time to talk to me like a father would to his own son. All the guys down at the port were the same way. About a year later, I went back there to say hello. I had lost a bunch of weight because I had started exercising, doing what I could to try to look good for headshots and auditions. The minute I walked in, I ran at the chick, the 60-year-old Italian speed chess master, who
who stopped what he was doing and stared at me. "What's the matter?" he said. "You're sick? You're so thin." He probably thought I'd gotten AIDS from going on auditions. "I'm not sick, chick. I landed a role," I said. "I'm playing a starving actor now." He looked at me dead serious and pointed his finger in my direction. "You listen to me," he said. "You come down here, you will always get a meal. You hear me? We will always feed you." As it happened, I didn't starve, and I didn't have to get another job before landing a paying gig in show business. It wasn't much at all, but I got a job right out of the fucking box in a dinner theater play. A friend told me about the audition, and I got it. It was a paid acting job, so I couldn't complain at all. The play was a murder mystery that was set in a catering hall, and I played a drunk priest with a southern accent who actually turned out to be the murderer, which I thought was kind of cool. And for obvious reasons, since there was booze on the premises, it was great to have to play a drunk. It allowed me to be method about it. For the first 3 months of 92, we toured restaurants and catering halls in North Central and South Jersey. We perform a five-act show, and between acts, we serve the audience their courses of food in character. That was cool because I'd have to improv with these people as a southern priest while serving them a salad. We got $40 a show, and since we were the waiters too, we kept the tips. On a good night, you could easily make an extra $100 that went right into your pocket. One of my fellow actors in that production was this kid, Jimmy Palumbo, who I'm still friends with today. Those of you who have seen Beer League will know him as Johnny Trino, the shortstop. We really got tight doing dinner theater. After 3 months, it was like we'd known each other all our lives. So when that run ended, Jimmy and I figured we'd try to make it in New York together, since it was better than going it alone. For the next 3.5 years, we'd take the bus or Jimmy's shitty Honda or my shitty Chevy Citation into the city, chasing our dreams. I did stand-up wherever I could. Jimmy and I both wrote and did sketch comedy, and eventually we got an improv group together that we called Live on Tape. This kid Mike Stafford was in it with us and produced it. And we did off-Broadway shows in a theater down on West 18th Street. Our show was a review of sketches and pre-taped bits of material. We'd do 2 live sketches. Then, while we changed costumes and set up for the next 2, we showed a tape sketch on a big screen so we didn't lose the audience, hence the name. Those shows did well enough that we got to do gigs at Caroline's, the famous comedy club. They let us do a bring-your-own show, which meant that they gave us the place from 7 to 8 p.m. before the real show started for the evening, and we had to sell our own tickets. 4 separate times we'd sold the place out. We did improv and sketches, and I did stand-up after. Those shows were really exciting. We invited friends down, and we always killed. The 4th time, a guy from the William Morris agency that Mike Stafford had met at a wedding came down. And not because he was really impressed with Mike or anything, but because we'd bombarded his office with flyers. I have a feeling that if Caroline's had been more than 2 blocks away from William Morris, we'd have never seen this guy. But the show that night was great, and that's how we met a commercial agent named Peter Principato, who ended up signing 5 of us. Jimmy and I were among the 5 that agency took on, and they started sending us out on auditions for commercials, which was a big, big step for us. Peter and I had a great working relationship for a while. He was my agent when I got Mad TV, and after he left the agency to become a manager, I went with him. He became my manager for 10 years, and even though we had a falling out, I still love the guy. I really miss Pete in a lot of ways, but our relationship became dysfunctional and had to end. It's too bad because Pete stuck with me through everything. When I got arrested while on Mad TV, which you will soon hear about, he flew to Los Angeles the minute he heard about it and waited with my sister for hours at the LA County Jail. I couldn't believe he did that. He just left his desk at William Morris without a care for his job or his other clients and flew out to L.A. I feel terrible about how it ended with Pete. The truth is, years later, it seemed like he wasn't doing much work for me after he'd moved to the West Coast. I guess it was too hard for him to be so far away and stay focused on my career. In any case, I didn't handle it how I should have. I said some shit about him on the air after I'd been on the show for a couple of years, and he wrote me a letter saying that maybe we shouldn't work together anymore. I responded by calling him and blowing my stack, and that's how we ended our relationship. I had my lawyer write a termination letter, and that was it. I wish Pete nothing but the best because he was there from the beginning, and he really stuck by me. I blame myself for the unpleasantness. It's one of the things I really wanted to make clear in this book. I am sorry that I'm not with Pete anymore, and I wish him the best. He's got a very successful management company in Beverly Hills now, so he's doing fine, but he was the guy who believed in me back in 1993, and he stuck by me, and I miss him. Show business is very bittersweet that way. Always was and always will be. You meet so many people and you grow so close to some of them, for a while you're working together toward a goal. Then some bullshit happens and you're enemies, or you end up not talking because there's some kind of weirdness between you and it really sucks. In so many ways, show business really sucks. Being on a stage or being on the radio or on TV or acting in a film is great. That's the high, that's the fun, that's what you do it for. But just about everything else, the business of it, most of all, is really fucked up, sad, and depressing. And that's when you're successful. When you're not, there's a whole other level of hell piled on top. Luckily for me, it was only 3.5 years between the day I quit working at Port Newark and the day I got cast on Mad TV. 3.5 years of struggling and being broke isn't bad at all, and I feel very thankful for that. I was only 27 when I got my big break and ended up on a network show where I made good money, and I've never looked back. Unfortunately, there's always a downside to all of my upsides. During those 3.5 years, I developed a terrible cocaine problem that I took on my back with me out to LA. It ended up costing me my job and a lot more before I got it under control. During my struggling years, the too fat to fish story became legendary. The phrase was emblazoned in our memory from the day my mom first screamed it loud enough to wake the neighborhood. We laughed about that story at every holiday meal. It never got old. Even though I am the punchline in the story, I loved it when my mother or sister brought it up because sharing laughter with them, cracking each other up around the dinner table, made me feel the way our family felt when my pop was still with us. I had to commemorate that story somehow because as time went on, too fat to fish became my mantra. I knew the outlet when I saw it. After my 2 years on Mad TV, where I was making close to 200 grand a year, I got a development deal from Fox that paid me 750 grand, so I was doing very well. I had enough money to start a corporation, so my Uncle Tom, who is a financial planner, told me to take my first $250,000 development check and incorporate myself. I remember holding that check, showing it to my mother, and wondering how many roofs my old man would have had to climb to make that kind of money. We decided it would have been about $500,000. Those were good times. I was able all at once to bail my mother out of every single financial debt she had. I was also finally able to do what I'd always wanted to do for her, buy her a house, a car, furniture, and anything else she wanted. I was finally able to be the man of the house for her like I'd always wanted. Money isn't everything, but it sure helps when you have it. And since I've had it, my mother has been a lot less stressed, and I'm very proud of that. Anyway, I named my company Too Fat to Fish. I went to the bank, opened the account with that check, registered it all through a lawyer, and told my mother nothing. I did get my mother her own account in the corporation, though with an official book of checks that had her name on it, at Too Fat to Fish Incorporated. When she saw it, she burst out laughing. "What did you do?" she said. "Why did you name your corporation that?" "You named it, Ma." The truth is, Too Fat to Fish is more than just a story to me. It represents all those times that I felt like a complete loser or was told I couldn't do something. But now that I've made something of myself on my own terms, the phrase is even funnier to me. It's a justification and an inside joke and a tribute to the mother who believed in me, except when it came to fishing, all at the same time. The only thing that matters is that I'm not too fat for comedy. And let's face it, can anyone ever be too fat for comedy?
Hi, I'm the Reverend Bob Levy, and I'm reading for Artie's audiobook of his book. Book. Because Gary the retard couldn't fly from Portland. Driving Miss Wasted. In 1992, I willingly left a job working as a longshoreman in the port of Newark and officially entered what I call the struggling years. My only regular form of employment at this point was driving a cab. It wasn't all bad. Of the many ways I've wasted time, both mine and other people's, for money, driving a cab was absolutely the best job I ever had. It was pretty enjoyable as far as struggling for a very meager living part-time jobs go. It was fun. And I have to be honest here, there were so many fucking losers working that job, the fact that I had an IQ over 80 made me the company's most valuable player. Competition was not tough among a group of guys who were barely able to spell their names as an X on their employment forms. Most people didn't carry cell phones in 1992, which in this particular field of employment really worked to my advantage. I spent most of my days making runs from Union Township to JFK Airport, a trip that involved crossing from our dispatcher's area into a huge Bermuda Triangle along the Belt Parkway where the company CB was out of range. I think it took me exactly 2 days to figure out precisely where we drivers entered the great unknown. It was the moment you hit Randazzo's Clam Bar in Sheepshead Bay. You passed Randazzo's out there on the belt, and then you were off the map, completely incommunicado. Randazzo's was a beacon of freedom on the horizon. I knew Randazzles from their classic low-budget commercials that ran during local Yankee television broadcasts. Their ads featured a guy fanning his mouth in the worst acting job ever captured on film, saying, "That Randazzles hot sauce, oh boy, is that hot!" Usually, I'd celebrate the fact that my boss could no longer track me for a while by stopping at Randazzles for a meal on my way to or from JFK. I spent all of my tips on calamari and cheesecake, which made me think that cab driving was my kind of job. If you think I'm bullshitting, hear this. I once got my driver's license suspended for DUI, and the next day, when I dragged my ass into the office and told the owner of the company that I had to quit because I was no longer legally able to drive anymore anywhere, he looked at me and as seriously as he could said, "Well, you know what? I won't tell anyone about it if you want to keep driving." I've never been what anyone would call a strict observer of rules, so I was more than willing to stay on. The truth is I owe my life now to that guy and that dead-end job and that crap reception of that crap CB system. Because if all those other factors weren't in place, I'd never have been able to drive myself into Manhattan while on the job for stand-up sets every night. Each of those early open mic experiences, as ugly as they were at the time, boosted me up, I didn't know why, and got me one step closer to where I am now. If that shitty cab company wasn't so fucked up run by that loose-as-fuck system they had going, I'd never have developed as a comic. Because it wasn't going to happen anywhere but in the clubs of Manhattan. This cab job was the kind of gig where the hours were so unbelievably flexible that I could pull off an insane degree of bullshit. I was actually able to become a regular at the comic strip on the Upper East Side without losing my job. I got a 20-minute set on any given night between Tuesday and Saturday. If I had a set from 9:30 to 9:50 at night, my dispatcher would let me drive the cab from 3 to 8:30. He would be cool with me taking the car into New York where I would double park in front of the comic strip and I'd get one of my comic friends to watch it while I went in to do a 20-minute routine. Then I'd run back out, get my cab, and drive back to New Jersey. As soon as I got through the Holland Tunnel, I'd call my dispatcher and say, "Hey, I'm back on." And then I'd work from 1 to 2 a.m. and make another $200 for the night. I'll say it again, it was the perfect gig for a guy doing his best to make it in show business via comedy. It also left me free to do auditions during the day for commercials. I drove the cab to get those too. The job was all cash too, so, you know, a cash gig never hurts either. Now that we're talking about cab driving, I realize for a very short, completely misled minute, I made the mistake of thinking that taking a job waiting tables might be a better career move. It's true, I thought being a waiter was a step up in showbiz. So for a millisecond, I was basically a walking cliché. I was a guy who wanted to make it, who would also never be a good waiter. On every level, this short-lived endeavor had to go. And it did, in a matter that was swift, decisive, and awful. My sister got me my one and only waiter job at a Mexican restaurant in Hoboken, right across the street from the PAT train. It was an easy gig, lunch 3 days a week, with an arrival time of 10:30 a.m. As I recall, my first day waitering went off without a hitch, though I really didn't like it at all. My second day was different. The night before, I went out drinking at a bar called the Rusty Scupper with my buddy Danny McGrath, who was a cop. I got ossified drunk, and for a reason I no longer recall, I got into a fist fight. I swung at a bouncer, and in response to my aggression, he took me by both sides of my hair and gave me what is commonly known among dickheads who get into fights in bars as the stop sign. You take somebody by both sides of the head and introduce their nose to your kneecap. That's what happened to me. My nose exploded. By the time the cops showed up, I was a mess and still drunk and ready to tussle. The officers were ready to arrest me, even though I hadn't done much more than get my nose rearranged. Luckily, my buddy Danny flashed his badge, after which his peers said to him, "Just get him the fuck out of here." Danny then drove me to Union Hospital, around the corner from where I grew up, and he waited with me for 3 hours while they patched up my nose. I was blacked out at this point. When my sister called early the next morning, I was already late for the lunch shift. I remember realizing two things after I told her I'd be there as soon as I could. I knew I was going to quit, and I also knew that my face looked like hamburger, and I had two black eyes. I didn't want to embarrass my sister either. But what I still don't understand is how I figured that showing up in the condition I was in would be less of an embarrassment than not showing up at all. So I got dressed and ran into the lunch rush at the restaurant. The manager just stared at me the moment I crossed the doorway. He didn't say anything, and he didn't get in my way, so I went about doing lunch. The first couple I served were two yuppies who could have been the cover of Yuppie magazine. Khaki shorts, polo shirts, and a BMW parked outside. I went up to them, took their drink order, and quickly returned with their drinks. I cleared my throat and said, "Do you want to hear the specials?" The woman said, "Yes," and looked up at me as I began reciting them. I was in a trance, kind of wondering, how was I even doing this at all? When I saw a look of horror come over her face, she started screaming, seriously screaming, and I had no idea why. "What? What?" I said. She looked like she just seen someone beheaded. She shrieked, "Your nose is bleeding." Sure enough, she was right. It was bleeding pretty good. Flowing all over my shirt, nice and red. The sight of it had this woman in complete panic. She was so out of her mind that the manager came running over before I could do anything about it. The manager was an intimidating, middle-aged Italian-American gentleman who hadn't, it seemed, gotten the memo informing everyone that carbs cause weight gain. He appeared at my side and dragged me into the back of the house and bitch-slapped me. He really got into it, too. I remember him pushing me up against the wall and getting in my face and hissing at me, "Get the fuck out of here! I never want to see you again!" He also accused me of getting into a bar fight and getting coked up the night before. He had that completely wrong. I got coked up before the bar fight. I didn't care about being roughhouse like that. I was fucking pissed off that I'd been fired before I could quit. Let me get back to the point here, which has to do with the worst experience I ever had at the best worst job I ever had. So I went back to the cab company after my brief interlude as a waiter. And this one night I drove the cab from like 10 a.m. to 3 a.m., which was the longest shift I would ever work. On top of that, I had the Knicks getting 5 from the Bulls that night. So I was watching the game at the dispatch station. The Knicks lost to the Bulls, of course. Fuck you, Michael Jordan. At 2:45 a.m., we got a call to pick up these two twits. It was a quiet night, but I was never what you might call ambitious at this job. So I still don't know why I agreed to take that last call. If there's one thing I learned driving cabs, and I learned it that night too, is this. That one last call is always the strangest you will ever get. Whatever. Then I didn't know. I took it on. I went out there. It was a pickup at a Holiday Inn in Kenilworth, New Jersey. A couple coming from a wedding. They needed to be taken to Route 22 West in Dunellen, which is about a half-hour drive. We all knew around the dispatch office that any wedding at a Holiday Inn at Kenilworth meant somebody was ringing the white trash bell loudly. So I got to the Holiday Inn, and the couple drunkenly spills into the back of the cab. I got their address, and the good news was that I kind of knew where that street was, so I would not have to bug them again, or so I thought. They were, as far as I could tell, a kid probably in a suit for the first time and his chick, a blonde in a black mini dress, really hot. I'd say she was a 9 or a 10. And both of them were in their mid-20s, but they were going on 57. As they came into my cab, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I wanted to freeze frame it. Being very drunk is fine, but what I couldn't understand is why they were behaving like horrible, old, extremely unhappy people. Not your run-of-the-mill unhappy people next door. They were unhappy, like the people who live in trailers on cops. From the outside, they had no reason to fight, but when they got into the cab, they were about to start hurting each other. I turned up the radio and listened to Allison Steele, The Night Bird, coming to me on 92.3 K-Rock. I focused on driving, thanking the stars above that I actually knew where we were going. About 5 minutes later, as we wound up on Route 22, I started to hear some serious clenched teeth arguing going on in the back seat. It was fight night for these two, and it was on. Every other sentence was like, fuck you, motherfucker. No, fuck that. Fuck you. I took a look in my rearview mirror and saw both of them red in the face, just really going at each other. Each of them just inches away from each other. Both flat out yelling. I turned the radio up a little louder and thought to myself, fuck it. 5 minutes later, I heard slap. Just a real solid slap, skin on skin. I hesitated again, then looked into the rearview mirror and saw my ears weren't lying. He fucking smacked her. Her lip was bleeding a little bit, and to make matters worse, he had one arm around her shoulders, holding her. And with the other hand, he was strangling her. I actually couldn't believe what the fuck I was seeing. At this point, I thought what any decent man would. I figured, like my girlfriend, this bitch must have a listening problem. Just kidding. At this time, I didn't even have a girlfriend. I pulled the car right over, leaned across the back of the cab, and grabbed the guy. He turned away from her and looked at me like I was the enemy. I said to him, dude, what are you doing? You are fucking killing this girl. If you keep this shit up, I'm throwing you out of the cab, I'm taking her home, and I'm calling the cops. I thought this was the obvious right thing to do, but I began to doubt myself as the girl looked at me blankly with a pair of drunken saucer eyes. She didn't seem to mind what was going on, and when the guy looked at me, I realized that I actually ruined some kind of moment for them. I never forgot what the guy said to me, because it was funny in a way that was so primal that there was no way at all that he could have possibly premeditated it. All right, man, he said. Then he put up his hands and waved me away. All right, then. Just drive, hero. Hero? Hero? I started driving again. I put the radio up while I worried that this guy was going right back to killing her. A few minutes went by, and I realized that it's been dead silent in the cab for some time. Fearing the worst, I took a look in the rearview mirror and saw that it's been silenced because these two idiots were making out in a crazy, sexy way. He had her skirt up over her top, and he was grabbing her ass. They were about 2 seconds from fucking. They went from the angry couple you see on Cops to the couple you see on Cops who got arrested for fucking in public. Clearly, their problem had resolved itself. So I returned to listening to music. That didn't last long. A minute or so later, I found myself distracted, wondering whether I'd rather clean up her blood or his jizz at the end of the night. And I gotta tell you, man, it wasn't looking too good for her as the debate went on in my head. But at this point, something far more serious took over. I started to realize I had a burning case of the shits coming on. I have never eaten well, and because of that, this shit thing happens to me every once in a while. I don't know if it was simply that, or if it was the sudden stress, but I can tell you this. It was fucking happening, all right. There was no doubt about it. These were the kind of shits where there was nothing to be done. These shits were coming. In a matter of minutes. No matter what. And they didn't care if my pants were on or not. I looked up just then, and thank God my passenger's exit was up ahead. Because as I turned down the ramp, I was about a mile from their house and about a minute away from leaking all over my cab. The situation was no joke. They were making out like nobody's business, and I was about to shit all over the front seat. And these two formerly fighting, now making out fuckers, were totally oblivious. They were sticking their tongues down each other's throat as I spread my legs and tried to hold my ass closed. All while driving a car with the gas pedal pinned to the floor. I blasted through red light after red light, looking for their address. It looked like I was gonna make it until I realized as I approached their house that I had to ask the guy in the back if I can use his bathroom. I figured it's been about 20 minutes tops since I almost punched him out and threatened him with police intervention. As I pulled into their driveway about 80 miles an hour, I faced the fact that I had a pretty shitty chance at winning them over and not much time to do it. We came to a screeching halt, and they were thrown all over the back seat. They stumbled out laughing and fell over each other on their way up the walk to the front door. I follow them. Not only because they haven't paid me yet. Dude, I said, trying to be at least a little bit cool. I gotta use your bathroom. All right, he said. Then his girl looked at me crooked. You cannot use our bathroom, she said. What? I asked, why? You're a stranger, she said. We don't know you. Who are you? We are not just gonna let you in the house. I looked at this girl, the same girl I tried to keep from being beat up by the guy swaying next to her. The guy looked at her, too. Even he thought it was bullshit. Honestly, at this point, I wanted to hit her if this shithead wasn't gonna do it again. Dude, man, I'm sorry, he said all slurry. She's a real cunt. She just fucking gets this way. It was beyond the point of no return for me. So when the guy handed me a bill, I grabbed it without looking. I ran to the car as fast as I could without letting it all go, because my bowels were liquefying. I mean, second by second as I was standing there. I drove to the nearest place I can find, a 7-Eleven. I ran in, probably looking like I was about to hold up the place. I grabbed the guy behind the counter by the shirt and I demanded a bathroom key. He could tell that I wasn't fucking around because I was so visibly uncomfortable and about to shit all over the room. No one in their right mind was going to keep me from doing what was obviously going to happen anyway. Mr. Clerk did the sensible thing and allowed me to let it happen in the right place. And finally, for the first time in what seemed like an eternity, I enjoyed some fucking relief. And that's when I realized that I was still holding the bill the guy from the cab had given me. That's also when I realized it was a 20 when it should have been a 50, which was the cost of the ride without the tip. So this little joyride from hell cost me $30, which came out of my money at the end of the night, as well as whatever tip I would have hypothetically gotten. At this moment, I felt a few things. I was relieved that my bowels had loosened themselves above a toilet, when just a few minutes before, I resigned myself to the worst-case scenario. I was also, after a moment's reflection, almost fine with the fact that I'd lost $30 to the negligence of those two model citizens. But what I really had a problem with, and the more I thought about it, the more I couldn't let it go, was the lack of tip. As far as I could tell, shits and speeding aside, I thought my service was impeccable.
I'm Jim Florentine, I'm one of Artie's friends, and I'm here because, I think he just is too lazy to finish the book, so he called me in to do it, and hey, I'll pick up the slack, no problem. He's throwing me a few bucks, and it's all good. And hopefully when my book ever comes out, when I don't feel like finishing it, he'll come in and rescue me. Pig and shit. It should be clear by now to everyone listening that I started abusing drugs and alcohol with particular gusto as a result of the sudden, tragic, and devastating accident that crippled my father and my family for 4.5 years. My mother and sister could have easily gone down the same road or a similar one to cope with the heartache, the stress, and the financial burden of living as a family in the aftermath of that event. Thank God they did not. They stayed strong and they took care of me too, as I found my way through my own suffering along a pretty dark, winding route. For the record, my sister supported my decision to chase my dream as much as if not even more than my mother did. After leaving the security of Port Newark and doing my first regular paying gig in show business, my stint in dinner theater, I dove into the New York City comedy club scene. I was cheered on by good friends like Jimmy Palumbo and Mike Stafford, as well as my mother's brothers and sisters, my younger cousin Frankie, and my older cousin Jeff, who might have been the biggest comedic influence. Jeff gave me my first George Carlin album, Class Clown, and Woody Allen's The Early Years, an album of Woody's greatest stand-up from the 60s. Without these people, I would have been really miserable. Drinking and drugs were, at first, a rebellious knee-jerk reaction to cover the pain and get through my shitty everyday life. But it changed on me, like it does to anyone with tendencies like mine. So during that period, I developed an addiction to cocaine and booze. It was easy to do. I spent as much time as I could for nearly 4 years in and around comedy clubs, which are hardly healthy, clean living environments. I met a lot of fellow dreamers in that world, and they introduced me to coke. I say introduced me because although I'd done it plenty of times before, I never experienced that drug the way I did then. Doing a bag of coke with your friends whenever some dealer was selling it in a bar was a universe away from doing gram after gram all night and into the next day and into the day after that with no end in sight to the supply. At that intensity, coke was a whole new drug to me, and I was happy to make its acquaintance. Once I started to get regular stand-up slots around town, it was a no-brainer. There were three-day periods where I'd just stay up the whole time, chasing the dream and the high. I'd do a gig, score some coke at a club, and keep doing it until my next time slot later that night. I might do another gig at another club and score some more coke there, then I'd go to after-hours places. I'd do more there, partying until the morning, hitting a few bars in the afternoon and finish my coke, and then go to another comedy club, score some more, and do another gig or two. Tuesday through Thursday, with proper planning, I could stay high nonstop without spending much money at all. That was great because I didn't have much to spend. People in audience at clubs always seemed to have coke and were eager to hang out with comedians. Believe me, if you were a regular comic, there were plenty of ways to get coke for free or very inexpensively. Cocaine makes fast friends, and one of my fastest best buddies at the time was this party monster who worked at a big Wall Street firm, loved comedy clubs, and had a corporate Amex that he enjoyed throwing down to cover bar tabs all night long. I remember thinking I finally seen the face of the devil one night at an after-hours club on the East Side when he used his corporate card to buy us more coke. I thought it was a joke, but this place actually accepted credit cards for cocaine purchases. The guy behind the bar swiped in and handed us an 8-ball as if it were a round of drinks. If that's not the embodiment of Satan in this day and age, I don't know what is. I looked at my buddy like he was Lucifer himself and decided right away that I was cool with hanging out with the devil as long as he can get me coke. That was my struggling period, and as I said before, I'm lucky it lasted only 3.5 years, until the day God opened the heavens and shone a golden light down upon me. I got cast on Mad TV as one of 8 permanent cast members chosen from 8,000 comics who had been screened. For any comic trying to make something of themselves, that was like hitting 777s. Jackpot. Landed a spot as a regular on a network sketch show in L.A. was specifically one of my dreams. Unlike a lot of comics, I didn't care about getting on Saturday Night Live. That show had such history and was so established that I didn't see the point. I wanted to be on an original show as an original cast member of a sketch comedy troupe, and I couldn't believe it when that exact scenario happened for me. In May 1995, I went to L.A. to shoot a pilot, which got picked up by Fox and put into the fall rotation, slated to debut on October 14, 1995. I was overjoyed that all this was happening for me after wanting it for so long because finally I felt justified in my life choices just a bit. So in July, I packed up and moved to L.A. ready to begin work on the show. I was 27 years old and everything was great, except for the fact that along with a bunch of old concert t-shirts, I took my crazy drug problem with me to the West Coast. I was now making huge money, $7,500 an episode plus a big signing bonus, all of which I intended to enjoy. I had my New York City drug dealer hook me up with a contact in L.A., and the second I got there, I continued doing coke like it was going out of style. Everything had done nothing but get better for me, so I saw no problem with it. I figured that I could live like that for years. My rationale for the whole thing was that someday I'd quit, and the best time for that was my late 30s. But right now, it was party time. Of course, I didn't realize at all how crazy and stressful shooting the show would be, and I thought it'd be sketch comedy as I'd done it in New York, which is creative and inspiring with some pressure involved, but it was mostly pressure we put on ourselves to be great. I had no idea how differently that would play out on a fully budgeted network program. For 3 straight weeks, 6 days a week, we rehearse sketches, then shoot them live in front of a studio audience on Fridays. Then we'd shoot commercial and movie parodies on location for 2 weeks. 1 week for rehearsal, 1 week for shooting. So there was no break for ages, and that's how it had to be. The format of the show was solid sketch comedy. We didn't have musical guests, so we needed 8 solid hours of sketches, each with different characters, voices, and everything else that was involved. There were only 8 cast members, so it was a lot of work, but I welcomed the challenge. I got through the first 8 episodes the way I've been getting through everything in my life, by drinking and doing a lot of coke and working as hard as I could. That was fine in the stand-up world because I was the only one responsible for my act and getting to the gig on time. But on Mad TV, there were 8 other cast members to consider, plus a huge crew, call times, schedules, union rules. It was too complicated for that kind of one-man show I was running. It was bound to come to a head, and it did. The last sketch we did before taking a break was called Babe Watch. We were shooting it way out in Malibu for 2 15-hour days, so instead of having everyone drive home, they put us up in this little motel. Babe Watch was a parody of Baywatch starring me as Babe the Pig, who becomes a lifeguard. If you had to equate me with a character on the real show, then I, as Babe the Pig, would have been David Hasselhoff. As you could see, the whole concept was ridiculous. The first day of filming this monstrosity was the worst day of my life in show business. My call time was 4 a.m. because I had to endure 3 hours of prosthetic makeup application that left me looking exactly, and I mean exactly, like a pig. The Mad TV makeup artist was as good as it got on TV. She had left SNL to work on Mad TV, and she was great. Her name is Jen Aspinall. I love Jen. She had a really sweet way about her. She still works there, and I wish her the best and miss her very much. Anyway, this mask was by far the most high-budget makeup effect I saw in the entire 2 years I worked on the show. After 3 hours in pig makeup, I had a snout, pig ears, a layer of white fuzz on my back, and 6 teats, each of which was going to get its own bikini top. And I was like a grunge pig. I had to wear a dirty flannel shirt, cut-off jean shorts, a wallet chain, and a backward baseball hat. They dressed me to look like a pig on his way to a Pearl Jam concert. They did a great job, too, because when Jen was done with me, I was disgusting. Just a two-legged, talking man pig. There's no other way to describe it. The skit was horrible in every way because there was way too much effort going into it. The whole thing was a cheap shot gag centered around me, the prosthetic pig. It was strange to be up so early getting transformed into a pig in a place that's as perfect as Malibu. It's that typical ideal California coastline of nothing but beach and sun and beautiful ocean that comes straight out of a Beach Boys song. The environment freaked me out. It would have been easy to take if I was in a studio. By the time my makeup was done, I was depressed and hungry. So I went over to the catering area, got some breakfast, and took it into my little trailer. I sat down and started to eat. But every time I went to take a bite of my eggs, I'd catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror. There I was, this pig, eating. I was hungry too, which made it worse, because I was literally a fake pig who was eating like a pig. Ugh, Jesus, I said out loud to myself, this is not why I signed up for show business. I finished the rest of my food, getting more and more annoyed with every bite. There was only one thing to do, call my Coke dealer. I told him where I was and asked him to come to meet me. I couldn't have him show up at the set, so he told me to meet him at Duke's, a seafood restaurant not too far away on the Pacific Coast Highway. It's got a huge self-park parking lot, which in L.A. is fucking rare because everywhere you go, there's a valet dipshit waiting to park your car and charge you anywhere from $3 to $20 to do it. I fucking hate that shit. Anyway, we decided to meet at Duke's. Can you get there, man? He asked. Oh, yeah, I said. There's no question that I'd get there. Without Coke to pass the 15 hours I had to spend in this pig getup, I would drown myself in the Pacific. Because I was the lead of the sketch, 2 assistant directors had to be aware of my whereabouts because it was their responsibility to wrangle all the cast members when it was time to start shooting. I was going to have to find a way to give them the slip. Apparently, they were having problems getting the lighting right for the first shot, so I seized the opportunity and sprinted in my car in the full pig outfit, teats, ears, and everything. As I sped away off the lot, I saw one of the assistant directors waving his arms at me. Hey, he shouted, his voice fading behind me. Where are you going? The Pacific Coast Highway is a winding 4-lane strip right on the edge of the ocean, and I tore down that thing at about 90 miles an hour, just a pig who wanted his Coke. My makeup was so good that the tone matched my skin perfectly, and every time I looked in the rear view, it was just uncanny to see myself that way. When I catch people's eye at traffic lights, they did a double take. I think at first they thought I was deformed, but after a second look, there was no mistake in that pig snout profile. If you were next to me, you would have said, look at that, it's a pig. Driving. I got to Duke's parking lot, went to the far end of it, like my dealer said, and sat there waiting. I was so antsy to get my drugs, so focused on the moment his car would turn into the parking lot, that after a while I forgot about the pig makeup, which was far from comfortable. When I finally saw my dealer drive in, it was like Jesus Christ appearing before me. I jumped out of the car and ran over to him. He was a black kid from inner city LA, and he was not prepared for what he saw. "What the fuck is wrong with you, man?" he said, genuinely disgusted. "The fuck kind of sick shit you into?" "Dude, I told you I was on TV," I said. "What the fuck kind of show you on, man? That shit ain't right." "I'm a mad TV, man. We're doing some stupid skit and I have to be a pig," I said. "No shit, you're on Mad TV," he said. "That shit is funny. You didn't tell me you're on Mad TV. Who's that blonde chick on the show, man?" "Nicole Sullivan." "Yeah, Nicole Sullivan. She's hot, man. You work with her? Damn, man, what's she like?" I then had to have a 15-minute conversation about Nicole Sullivan with this guy in my full pig face, standing outside in the parking lot of Duke's. And after that, he wanted to know all about what it was like to work on a comedy show and how we came up with all the shit we did on the air. The concept of team writers was definitely new to him. While this incredibly painful dialogue went on, I was on the verge of literally attacking the guy to get my fucking coke. I would have just told him I didn't have the time and thrown my money at him, but I didn't have the cash to cover the eight ball I ordered, so I felt I had to hang out and endure his endless line of questioning. He was a great drug dealer, this guy. He came with a line of credit, so I could put the coke on my tab. I'm sure he didn't give everyone that treatment, but I was on a TV show, so he knew I was good for it. Besides, at the time, I was what any drug dealer would call a very good customer. The only thing I felt incredibly guilty about is that back then Nicole Sullivan was single, and I totally forgot to tell her that she could have dated this guy. After I got my eight ball, my dealer took off. I started tearing through my backseat looking for something to do it with. That didn't take long. Like a true coke addict, I had a nice selection of cut straws available. I was so focused on my drugs that I forgot again about the pig mask as I went to stick the straw on my nose. The thing hit my snout, bent in half, and got nowhere near my actual nostril. I tried it like three times, wanting to get the coke in me so bad that my brain did not compute why the hell the straw wasn't connecting my nose to the drugs. I pinched the end of the straw, got in there good enough, and sniffed as hard as I could, expecting my snout to work just like my real nostril. Obviously, that failed miserably. I was on the verge of opening it all up on the passenger seat and just stuffing my whole snout in a desperate pig-like attempt to get high. I hoped to do my drugs without disturbing Jen's work, but that wasn't happening. So I took the straw and started to dig with abandon into this expensive prosthetic stuff like I was tunneling out of a prison. Finally, I managed to crack a hole in the bottom of the snout and get the straw up there and into my nose. I inhaled a line of coke as fast, as hard, as if it was my first drink of water after walking across the Sahara. At that moment, I didn't give a fuck about where I was, what I looked like, or what kind of shit I was going to get for walking off the set. Those people could all fuck themselves as far as I was concerned. All I cared about was getting some relief. Sure enough, once I was high, everything got a little better. So of course, the obvious decision was to feel a whole lot better by doing a whole lot more coke before I went to work. But since I was now high, I was also now paranoid that everyone on the set would know I'd run out to get coke. I was also worried that Jen would see that I poked a hole in the snout the size of a straw. I kept trying to look at the damage in the mirror in the sun visor to make sure I didn't have blow all over my face. I bent the thing every which way, but for the fucking life of me, I couldn't see under that snout. Every time I lifted my head high enough, my big pig cheeks blocked the view. My only option was to go into the restaurant bathroom to do my drugs as comfortably as possible. As I walked through Duke's parking lot, cars driving by 200 feet away on the highway slowed down to honk at me like I was fucking Santa Claus, but I didn't care. I went inside, walked right by the hostess stand, through the bar and restaurant, directly into the bathroom. Nobody stopped me. I think they were much too freaked out for that. In LA, there are always actors in costumes doing shit around town, so who knows? Maybe they'd already seen a monkey and a donkey come through that day. In the bathroom mirror, I saw that I dug a gaping hole in this prosthetic snout that was covered, as I expected, with white powder. I tried to close it up and hide the damage, but it was fucked. There was a loose flap clinging by a thread. I was now a pig with a deviated septum. Fuck it, I thought, and I went to a stall, sat down on the toilet, and did more lines. When I got back to my car, I realized that I'd been gone for over an hour and still had a 20-minute ride back on the Pacific Coast Highway. Faced with those odds, the only thing that made sense to me was a quick blast of coke for the ride. By now, my straw was no longer necessary. I'd successfully fucked up the makeup to the degree that I could easily do a key hit, which is just what it sounds like, a small pile of coke on the end of a key. I did one of those and started making my way down the PCH. Every time I hit a traffic light, I stopped and did another key hit because I felt so shitty about both the skit and the fact that I was fucking up so bad by being so late. At one red light, as I maneuvered the key up my snout, I felt eyes on me. I turned to my left and saw this fucking hot Malibu chick with long blonde hair and sunglasses, just smoking hot, driving some sort of Lamborghini convertible. She was there with her girlfriend, and the look on their faces was insane. They must have thought they were on an acid trip, sitting there looking at a pig in broad daylight doing cocaine. I just stopped and stared back at him with the key in my hand. Then the driver leaned over so she can get a better look at me and said, kind of disorganized and pointing, "That's a pig doing cocaine." She might have said that, I don't know. I'm going with the odds here and assuming she didn't say, "Hey, you're hot, can I blow you?" I just wanted to kill myself. I thought of my mother holding me in the hospital as a baby, staring into my face, never knowing that one day her baby boy would be in pig makeup at 10 in the morning doing blow at a traffic light. I heard my mother's voice in my head, horrified, saying, "Look at my son. Look at him. What's happened to my son?" I was miserable. The light turned green. I started driving with the hit of coke still balanced on the key in my hand. I started weaving in and out of lanes, trying to get this thing in my nose, and ended up cutting off this old lady and almost causing an accident. I got back to the set and put on the rest of my costume. A red Baywatch bathing suit featuring 12 boob cups to hold my 6 set of teats. I stashed my coke in one of them and made some excuse to Jen, the makeup girl, about what happened to the snout. I told her I was drinking coke from a can when it broke. Finally, 6 hours after waking up and 3 hours after my scheduled start time, I joined the cast on set. It was obvious from like 300 yards away that everyone from my fellow actors to the last crew guy wanted to fucking kill me. They were all just livid. My best friend on the show, David Herman, an amazingly talented actor, walked right up to me, looking more pissed than I'd ever seen him. "Artie, you almost got the 2 assistant directors fired," he said. "What the fuck? You have to let those guys know if you're gonna go somewhere." "Oh yeah? Well, fuck you, Dave." "What? What did I do?" "You heard me. Fuck you. I don't give a fucking shit about you or those 2 fucking guys." I gave him the finger and stormed off. We didn't speak for 2 weeks. I then did the sensible thing. I went back to my trailer and did more coke until it was time to shoot. It was one of those times when cocaine wasn't at all fun. It just got me through the day because that was the kind of user I'd become. The drugs did have the unwelcome side effect, however, of making the day more and more strange with each passing minute. Every time I bent over to do a line, I'd catch my reflection in the mirror out of the corner of my eye, and I'd see me as a pig doing coke. I was a pig doing coke. It was as simple as that. It did wonders for my self-esteem and my growing self-loathing at being an addict. The monologue in my head was like a broken record. I'm a pig. I'm a fucking coke addict pig. I'm a fucking drug addicted pig. The pig costume was more than a symbol of me. As high as I was, when I saw myself in the mirror, I had turned into a pig. A pig who overate and did coke. When you did impressions on Mad TV, the producers gave you a Walkman that played huge sections of whatever movie was being parodied, with your character's catchphrases recorded on a loop. You'd wear this thing around during rehearsals and for a week listen to the voice you had to impersonate over and over again. It drove all of us crazy. When David Herman had to do Pauly Shore, he almost quit. David is a really mellow, great